Hello and welcome to Unfrozen, episode 24. I'm your co-host, Greg Lindsay.
And I'm Dan Zafarik.
As always, joined by Dan Zafarik. Inverting the order today because you're the one who has a guest. Dan, who is our guest today?
Today's guest is Matt Nardella of Moss Design. It is a multidisciplinary design firm here in Chicago. He comes to us by way of a shared colleague, actually, who worked with us. I want to give a shout out to Emily for introducing us.
Well, great. Well, before we have Matt on, I want to catch up, Dan. Last time we recorded, you were here in Montreal, here in my home office. But then we parted ways and traveled across continents. So how was the Fairmont Montebello and the world's largest log cabin?
Oh, well, it's a beautiful building. I had been there before. It is a, it was a private club. I think I incorrectly said on the previous podcast that it was established by the Canadian Pacific Railroad, but that's actually not true. It was built using logs from British Columbia, which is quite a feat in 1930, considering the technology then, with labor, something on the order of 4,000 people in a matter of like 14 weeks. So one of these incredible Depression era construction projects for a private club, which was later then sold to the Canadian Pacific Railroad and opened as a public hotel in 1970. And then some point in the early 2000s, I think it got transferred to the Fairmont Group. So it is now a Fairmont Hotel. A lovely place with an eight-sided octagonal fireplace in the center and a hallway extending in every direction. Hey, it looks like we have you can't hear it, but you could maybe see it. We almost had a guest appearance. Greg, can you introduce our guest star?
Yeah, special guest here in the background is Whitaker today. I say, welcome to the post-COVID reality here where now children are just home for things like croup again. So we'll see how I'm in and out in our interview today, but don't let me interrupt our travels because I've been all over as well.
Indeed. Yeah, just to wrap up, it is billed as the world's largest log cabin, and it definitely fits the bill. Very old school. I can't believe that Wes Anderson has not filmed a movie there because it is so Wes Anderson, down to the minuscule, like child-sized stage underneath the split staircase that comes from the upper level down to the lower level where the dining room is. And it's surrounded by tomahawks on both sides. Like, it is literally the most Wes Anderson thing ever.
It's very problematic, in other words, then. Sounds problematic.
It could be seen that way, although, you know, Canada's gone a lot further in acknowledging their, let's say, relationship with their Indigenous peoples than the United States has.
Well, that's the thing about Canada. Acknowledgement is about all we've done, but that's a story for another podcast. Well, while you were at the log cabins, the closest I got to a Wes Anderson, I crisscrossed the country a few times since we last spoke, but the most scenic and architecturally significant place I probably was, other than a series of luxury hotels, Whitewater, which is a charming inn on the coast of California in Cambria, California, not far from where your parents live. Thanks again to your father for the excellent vineyard recommendation. But it was really interesting for me. My first time on the Central Coast, I'd written about this. It's the area of California, which is basically, as far as I understand it, emptied out because home prices in places like San Luis Obispo are so high that all the children have left. Like, basically, it's like sort of like the dark heart of California's real estate driven prosperity. But we spent a lovely time in an inn there on Moonstone Beach. Moonstones are tiny little pebbles that have been worn down. And it was my first time driving the Pacific Coast Highway. The only time I could ever say I really got close to being in a car commercial. I finally understood like what driving actually meant culturally. And I don't know, I'll stop riffing in a moment because just as like I riffed on like Montreal without being Francophone, I could finally understand like, oh, I understand why California exported car culture to the United States because it was actually resplendent for a brief 3 hours there driving to the PCH. So, but it's good to be back home and it's good to be back with you. And I've got to go chase Whitaker around the house. I'll be popping in and out of our interview, but what are we talking about with Matt today?
Well, we're basically going to do a little bit of a mini profile of the firm. And actually your mentioning of California and the PCH highway actually is a pretty good segue to introduce Matt, because as I understand it, he spent quite a bit of time out in the California and San Diego, which is also a great place to film car commercials. And I'd like to hear a little bit about his journey back to Chicago, which has some parallels to my own. I lived in LA for 7 years. So I think we have a lot to talk about there. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about your educational journey and then your work in California and what brought you back to Chicago.
Sure. So yeah, I think it starts a little bit before even my schooling, but I feel like I was always destined for architecture. I think even before I was able to form memories, I wanted to be an architect. My mom kept this memory book, it was called. I still have it. And it was a place to every year after the school year is done is to put your report card and write down who your friends were and what your hobbies were. And then in the last line was what you want to be when you grow up. And looking back in first grade, I wrote policeman, or actually I wrote FBI policeman. Must have been some movie I saw at the time. And then second grade and beyond, I wrote architect. And I don't remember doing that, but I did. And it has led me to today. But as far as getting out to California, so I'm from Chicago. I grew up in the Northwest suburbs, very near the capital of McMansions in Barrington. Not in Barrington, but next adjacent. We weren't wealthy enough to live in any of those McMansions. We lived in a pretty normal tract home in the suburbs. But the high school that I went to had a really good drafting program. And it was a time when AutoCAD was just starting to come out. And AutoCAD was the prevailing design software that architects were using. It had been hand drawing before that, and then AutoCAD started. So I was just coming up through high school at the time where that was becoming popular, and turned out I was good at it. So I was all set to go to IIT in Chicago to start college. But about maybe 2 months before I graduated high school, I got a call from a recruiter from New School of Architecture in San Diego that I'd met a few months before that at some kind of college fair at the Art Institute downtown. And they called and said, you know, we are starting to increase our drafting lab and we need an assistant there to run it. Would you like to do it? And we'll pay for or give you a scholarship for several years of your study here. So I thought about it for all of 5 seconds and said, you're going to pay me to go to San Diego? Sure. I'll
that's a deal.
Yes, I'll take it. So I have a lot of my aunts and uncles are in Southern California. So, and I've been to LA and San Diego a lot before that. We'd always go there on summer vacation because my grandparents lived in San Bernardino County. So I was familiar with it. I knew it was great. And I loved it. So I went to New School there, it was great. I worked in an office during an architecture studio for that entire time, while I was in school and 3 years after, and got licensed, in California, which is the only state to still have an oral exam as part of their 9, written exams. I think the written exams are now less, but when I was taking the test, there were 9 plus an oral in California, which the pass rate is 49%. And I thought I failed after taking it, but I ended up passing on the first go. So I got licensed there, worked there for a little longer, and I met my now wife in San Diego, and she happened to be from Chicago too. You only have to go 2,000 miles to meet the person you're going to marry, I suppose. So we decided, we knew we were going to move, and we, amongst the candidates, Chicago was one of them, and knew we wanted to start our own business of some kind. Laura has a marketing and business development background, which is great because in architecture school, they teach us that we get 1 semester of professional practice. So they don't expect us to be business people. Laura and I, in 2009, after being back in Chicago, started Moss, and been doing that ever since.
That's quite a journey. And we have a number of parallels in there that we probably don't have a podcast's worth of time to get into, but very exciting. So I had assumed when I saw your profile and description on the website that it was actually the New School of Design in New York, but is it related to the one in San Diego or not at all?
No, I'm not sure if that was a marketing ploy or not, but it has nothing to do with them. So our new school is one word. I believe the one in New York is two words. So whatever the case, in the late 80s or early 90s, UCSD had an architecture program and they disbanded that around that time. So there weren't any architecture schools in San Diego at all for the longest time. So new school started, around that same time, late 70s, early 80s, in a little warehouse building in downtown San Diego. It's actually now where the ballpark is. So it was when I was going to school there, it was pretty run down. The trolley went by, which was kind of quaint. They were the only architecture program for a while. And then Woodbury, who's in LA, they opened up a satellite campus in San Diego. So now there's two at least. But yeah, for the longest time there wasn't an architecture program at all. So New School filled that gap. But no, they have nothing to do, as far as I'm aware, with that other New School.
Got it. So when you got back into business here, were you predominantly thinking in terms of the, you know, just fundamentally doing small residential projects, or were you, how did you get sort of on the path to, a viable business?
I always knew that I wanted to start my own practice, mainly because I didn't really see in architecture anyone doing quite what I wanted to do, which I feel like was a little bit beyond what the traditional architecture role is. We've been sort of pigeonholed as a profession into this one little slice of property development or how properties get developed. And architects used to be the master builders as recently as maybe even 100 years ago. We were the ones that were deciding how properties were developed, actually designing it, and then being what you would refer to today as the contractor, so managing the construction. And I wanted to explore all those facets of property development. I didn't see any other architecture firms doing that. The traditional way is to kind of sit around and wait for clients who want to develop property to come see you, and then you do their drawings and then you leave. And I didn't really want to do that, and wanted to do it more for ourselves. And I credit a couple of instructors or studio professors I had in San Diego that were doing architect as developer work, and they were acquiring property and building and designing and being the GC all on their own, and then becoming the landlord or selling them off as for sale units. So that's what I wanted to do, and I didn't really see many architecture firms that were doing anything even remotely close to that. And I have other interests outside of architecture, and wanted to not only pursue those, but also find a way to fold those into our practice. So I like food and wine and beer. So we thought, well, why don't we try and target restaurants, wineries, and breweries, because we like those things. Let's find out if they can use our help when they're designing their buildings or their spaces. And that also is not something that's traditionally done in architecture, is, directly marketing who you're, we're just bad at business generally. I've talked to some older architects, and, up until fairly recently, it was even unethical to market. I don't know if we didn't want to get mixed up with the like attorneys that run late night commercials and, ambulance chase. We didn't want to be associated with them. I'm not really sure what the reason was, but, sitting back and just waiting for your ideal client just didn't really make sense to me. I thought, why don't we just go find the ones that we actually do want to work for some of our work? And then for the rest, let's build the projects that we want to develop and own ourselves. And that's how we ended up where we are today. So just as much as we're doing it because of architecture, we're also doing it because Laura knows about business development and has really shaped us to be that.
I just want to interject here because I'm curious about like who are your sort of inspirations here of like architects as developers. I think I have my copy here of John Portman's actual book, The Architect as Developer. Yep. And I remember reading in Joel Grow's Edge City where like, you know, we're basically like other architects despise Portman. Like they wanted to drum him out of the AIA for being a developer. And so other than that, I'm curious, like, are there other inspirations here? Because of course the Portman family, I mean, they've morphed into more developers than architects over time. I think they're John Portman IV is currently running the family firm. But yeah, are there others? Because like the alternative, it's funny you say that, like marketing is sort of like frowned upon. I guess the alternative to that is if you're a certain level of star architect, you get to go like pose with like authoritarian leaders of other countries to develop clients. But yeah, how did you guys get into development?
Yeah, I feel like other architects are probably just jealous because we all secretly want to just do what we want and don't want the developer to be determining what the project is. So, you know, we see it more as a design solution where, you know, the typical developer designs their projects on spreadsheets. And I don't feel like that is benefiting anyone, but especially the property for which the building is being built. So, Portman, I think was, I don't know if he's technically the first, but as far as I knew, the first introduced to me was Ted Smith, who's an architect in San Diego. He is an older guy and is still around, but was really bucking what it meant to not only be an architect, but I feel like finding the gray zones of the zoning ordinance and building codes. And at the time in Southern California, even now, it's not very density friendly. And Ted's main goal, aside from being the developer and the architect, was to find a way to add more units to sites because the sites could support them. And he knew it, and most people knew it, but you know, trying to upzone properties is all but impossible, still is, in a lot of ways. So he was one that was an instructor of mine that I thought was great. Jonathan Siegel is the other who's made it, has become more famous because of it. So we talk about marketing. I think he is the ultimate marketer for it. He's even developed a series of seminars and webinars about how to be an architect developer. But I was lucky enough to be introduced to him. I lived in a couple of his buildings. I also lived in a couple of Ted's buildings too. So those were the two architects that I think were doing what I thought I wanted to do. And they did, and a little bit of luck on top of it all too, because they did just get, they were bequeathed with a giant parcel in downtown San Diego in Little Italy that, you know, no one wanted to live in at the time, but now is popular and expensive. So, you know, they're both great designers and both know what they're doing and both great developers, but a little luck helped too. But I was lucky enough to be in their studio classes and realize that that could be done. I think that shaped where I wanted to take my eventual architecture practice.
It's funny you mentioned Jonathan Siegel. That name like brings back so many memories because I used to work for what was then Pugh and Scarpa and is now Brooks and Scarpa, and he and Larry Scarpa. I think Larry was one of those sort of design-driven architects who was kind of more the traditional, you know, sort of gentleman architect in the sense that he had a little bit of a sense of, he was not marketing averse, but I mean, I was the marketing director that he hired, so I guess he wasn't marketing averse. But on the other hand, I was the marketing director that he hired, so you know, I think he felt like the design should stand on its own and he didn't co-develop a lot of properties, but I could tell that he was a very big fan of Jonathan's. We went down to one of those properties in Little Italy in San Diego, and we were walking through an empty shell and John, it was like Jonathan Siegel was like on stage at you know, on the Tonight Show or something. He was just for an audience of two, you know, in hard hats, but I could tell like he had the salesmanship and he had his patter down and everything. And he talked, I think he has like some crazy amount of luxury cars that he talks about all the time. It's nuts. Like the guy's like a superstar.
I made the maybe unfortunate decision to look at his Instagram for a while. And, you know, it was mostly, yeah, classic cars. So interestingly enough, he went to the University of Idaho. So did my boss at the office I was working at in San Diego, They both graduated together. I feel like there was maybe a little bit of jealousy happening. I'm not sure. But you know, you can't argue that Jonathan's a good designer. And you know, I appreciate, aside from what he's doing just practically, I do appreciate his massing design and how he lays properties out. I think it's really, really well done. But he does, you know, have a way of boasting, which you know, some people might say is being full of yourself. But hey, if you do good work, then have at it. People can like you or not, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, I think the whole question of the architecture culture is a really relevant one. You know, and one of the things that I think in the interim between the two podcasts that we recorded, this one and the previous one, there was a huge controversy that emerged at SciArc, where two of the program directors were put on administrative leave after hosting a what I thought was a fairly straightforward, if typical, kind of presentation to the students about what it was like to really work in an office. And their bent on it was sort of, well, you know, you need to decide if you want to work in an office for 40 hours a week and hate your life, or work in a boutique or an atelier, as they kept referring to it, a small office that was design forward, and love your life. And those are your only two choices. It seemed a little bit out of step with 2022 and the way that, you know, workplaces are changing. You know, student movements are gelling. People are becoming more, I mean, I hate to use the umbrella term woke, but I mean, you know, people are becoming a little bit more sensitive about how we deal with other people in our communities. So, you know, it did seem a little out of step, but I also sort of, I was very torn when I heard this presentation, because everything seemed like everything they said was true, but they also seemed sort of arrogant about it. And I think that it was the latter part that probably upset people. And I feel like we bounce this sort of idea around about design culture in small firms, but I've been out of one for so long that I don't feel like I have a place to say what it's really like. So that's why I thought I'd bounce this somewhat thorny question over to you as a practitioner. But I think Greg wants to interject first.
Well, I want to add to that too, Matt. I mean, as architects, is development also a way around this? Because in a previous episode, we had Eva Hagberg on, and we talked a bit about the faltered efforts to unionize shop, which gets into that too, where, like, you know, unionization of staff would directly impact the entire architectural model of, like, you know, brute force architecture and brute force possibility designing, which, you know, we've talked about with also with Brian Boyer on here about the sort of OMA model of, like, get the associates and the interns and just have them, like, cut foam until something reveals itself. So is architecture as development a way out of that, where you can change the financial models, where it's not like we have to jump to the client's brief and we basically have to undercut any potential rival with labor costs? I don't know. Have you solved this equation for us, Matt? How do we figure this out?
I think it's definitely a way. And if we need any more evidence that discussion is happening in the higher reaches of the ivory tower, then, you know, using Altieri 100 times in a conversation. But so I saw the headline, didn't read the article about the SciArc thing. I'm based on what you're saying, it sounds a bit over the top, but you know, I don't feel like I work 60 hours a week and I'm perfectly happy. So I don't think it takes that in order to do it. Maybe in those kind of offices, and I know they exist, that, you know, you're expected to work ungodly hours for little or no compensation. And, you know, I think it marginalizes us as a profession that we're willing to do all this work for free. And if that's ingrained in us from an early age or early in our career, then what's the hope for the future? Like, we shouldn't be giving our time away. We're valuable. We have valuable time as professionals. And, you know, there's all kinds of evidence of it in the field, in that, you know, we're still kind of in the starving artist sort of role, rather than in the professional role. Like, you know, you think about doctors and lawyers, you know, we have just as much training. We take more exams than lawyers do to become licensed. Doctors, if they make a mistake, they can just bury it. But the best thing that architects can do is just plant ivy on it. So, you know, we do have, that's not my line, by the way, that's credited to Frank Lloyd Wright, but I like it. We shouldn't be giving our time away. And so I don't want the precedent set early in our careers that we should be just for this idea of working on your dream project someday. Clients see it. And if we're going out to job sites, to try and, find work to give free advice to potential clients who might just be kicking the tires, I'm not interested in doing that. I rather people see the work that we have done, both as a developer and an architect, and then say, I want to work with this person. And we should then be interviewing them to make sure that they understand our process and are interested in a good design solution. And I feel like the tables are usually turned. So we're the ones that are the professionals, and we should be being compensated for our time. No one should be working for free. And I don't expect that of the people that work at our office, and I don't expect that of me either. If we're spending time on a project, then we need to be paid for it. And it's pretty much as simple as that.
Yeah, I mean, it sort of seems like, architects, of course, have reputations of, for being, prideful or arrogant or whatever word you want to use. But it always seems like they don't seem to exhibit enough pride in themselves as a profession when looking up to their funders, but looking up to their clients. It's always punching down, it's like beat up the interns, beat up the rank and file kids who are just trying to earn their licensure and do a good job, and that just seems totally wrongheaded. I mean, you do solve some of the problem by taking over more of the columns of the overall job. If you are both the client and the contractor and the designer, you have a lot more leverage, of course. But, obviously not everyone can do that. And if you can do that, you might be limited in the size of the projects you're able to take on. But then one would hope then you would maintain a sense of balance and have a reasonable amount of people on your staff that you can pay well and are happy working there. It just seems like people overshoot in terms of their artistic or their design ambitions and really undersell in terms of their value and the work that they do.
Yeah, all depends on what kind of work you ultimately want to be doing, I think. I'm not interested in the, how larger offices are set up and in their kind of silo of what people do, where you have the design people over here on one side of the office and then the technical people on the other side. And, we're design people work up, the fancy renderings and drawings and then hand over the technical side and here you take care of it. So, that sort of model, I don't think produces or has less likelihood of producing good results. That's the way it has to happen on large projects. I don't think so, but maybe it's the way that they think it does and it has to be set up that way so that they're profitable. But I don't think it ultimately benefits us as members of society that's how projects are being designed and built, because I think you lose something when you're not understanding how something can actually be put together when you're working on off in this cloud working on the design. You need to really understand how it gets built, and that's another reason why we need to be building more as architects and being the contractor more. And I just as there's architects as developer, I see it as architect as builder, that we should be more responsible for the general construction of things and communicating with all the subcontractors, because that's really all the general contractors are doing. They're organizing all the subs and tradespeople that are on site. And architects are usually disconnected with that. When's the last time an architect at one of those big offices talked to an electrician? It's probably been a while. So, understanding their needs and how they view projects and how they look at drawings, I think that needs to be understood, and it certainly informed our work and how we go about designing things and detailing things Not only, you know, can we do it cost effectively, but can anyone actually execute this? And if you're not thinking about that when you're designing on day one, I don't see how you can be making successful architecture. But that's just me. Maybe they've maybe figured it out. But I think there's a reason why, you know, things maybe don't improve as fast or as nicely as we hope. You know, I usually use the example of hospitals that, you know, the same three companies probably design and build all the hospitals in the country. And then we wonder why people get sicker in hospitals. Well, no one's really examined how they work and how people might feel better inside of them. It's just this machine that kind of churns them out. And you know, everything's become, it's even down to like veterinary clinics, that there's the same design build firm that builds probably 90% of the vet clinics in the country. Is that good for buildings and properties and sites and clients? Probably not, but that's the way they've figured out to most efficiently turn these things out of offices and onto land. And I don't think that's a good model for anything, but that's why we are trying to do it a little differently.
Well, the question I asked there is, have you discovered any particular efficiencies or where that comes together? So I recently hosted a virtual masterclass for New Cities on like the intersection of housing and climate. And one of our presenters was Jeremy McLeod and Maria Yenes of Nightingale Housing. I don't know if you know Nightingale. They're out of Melbourne, but they were architects and they sort of developed this integrated housing model that sort of like borrows from like German Baugruppen in a way. Like they put caps on costs and profitability because architects are developing it. But then they also showed us some of like the ideas they had were like, you know, I mean, bare concrete ceilings, you know, making the structural elements plain, you know, there were all sorts of interesting sort of design flourishes that architects knew that would bring down heating costs and allow them to basically rely on renewables, et cetera, et cetera. I can keep going. But I thought it was a really interesting example of the applicability of design to basically understand how that directly impacted back into costs and where it would reduce, you know, reliance on traditional HVAC and things. You know, they could put, you know, heating and cooling up on the roof and, well, that's a misstatement there, but do you see my point? I'm just curious if you found similar things in this where like, basically like what can architects discover in the course of this that causes them to pencil out more easily?
Yeah. So, and you know, all those things you mentioned and, you know, they're mostly revolving around sustainability. Which you know was just a word when I started my career, but now has completely infiltrated construction and design, and for good reason. But it's always been thought of as something you need to buy into. You know, I need to spend more money in order to accomplish this, and I don't feel like that's true. And the way that we design, it's not. There are all sorts of free elements out there that if we just understood them and acknowledged them, and we're able to fold them into our design and therefore make the building less expensive and use less energy to operate. And that's usually referred to as passive design, meaning we're not using active systems to heat and cool the building as much as we otherwise would. But it needs you to take a step back from the project, understand what the site is and what it wants. You know, we shouldn't be just implementing and supplanting nature with our ideas, but how do we actually work with it and allow it to infiltrate our site so that we're using it to our advantage? And these are all not new things. The Pueblo Native Americans 1,000 years ago built Casa Grande with all that in mind. Survived there because they built their housing in relation to the landscape. And that's what I think we've probably been missing out on for the past 70 years, is that we have looked at housing and buildings from an economic perspective and not a how can this actually benefit the land that it's on. And you know, our design, I think, does that. And it's only because we try and understand what the site is. Site analysis. I mean, it's the probably the first semester of your first year in undergrad is how to analyze a site, but how does that actually transition to what the building looks like? And that is usually what's missed. And by building and occupying buildings and then having to pay for their energy needs, we're able to understand what it is that is affecting our buildings and then how to problem solve so that they don't.
How many of your projects overall are traditional, you know, client, architect, contractor, you know, traditionally bid out projects, and how many of them are design build or owned by Moss?
I would say it's probably 60-40 traditional to not. Even when we do have the what you would say more typical, you know, design bid build sort of setup, we still take a little bit of the project off on our own, especially like the millwork and cabinetry and interior finishes. And, you know, we still, I guess you would say GC that portion of the project, even when we're not the GC for the entire project, just because we have it, we have the infrastructure set up that we can do that easily, and helps us keep better control over those parts of the project. So, you know, we fabricate freestanding furniture from time to time for people, but it also goes into a lot of our projects. So we know how to do it and we have it set up. So even in the more traditional model, we're still somewhat acting as a contractor in some way. The majority is still, you know, traditional architecture that a general contractor is building for us and the client. And I don't want to completely give that up, because I think it still grounds us, and I still want to be talking to clients and understanding what they need and what their perspectives are. If we went 100% architect as developer, much like Jonathan has, I feel like we lose that. And I wouldn't want to do that, because I think we lose a piece of what's important to architecture if we do that completely. But I certainly want to be doing more of architect as developer and builder as much as we can and make sense.
Yeah, it just makes sense. I mean, just especially at the scale that you're working and the way that you can maintain control over it and just sort of be really exposed to the realities that all of the parties in these complex transactions actually face. It's a pretty rich field that you're able to mine by doing that. So I'm curious about, I saw that, you know, you have a very nicely illustrated website, not only in terms of, you know, images as would be typical, but you have a pretty active blogging atmosphere where you've got, what I now learned is, I guess that's your wife and business partner doing a lot of it. But obviously our shared colleague has done some, and looks like some of the other designers have done some, which I think is great. And some of the things you've talked about or advocated for, I'd be interested to see how the practices work has dovetailed with that. For example, things like the ADU ordinance here in Chicago, where for 64 years, I think, it had been forbidden to construct what is informally known as a granny flat, an accessory dwelling unit in an alley in the city. And in several pilot areas, the city's now backed off of that and is testing the potentiality of building ADUs. Interestingly, at a time when in the West Loop, I think I read a statistic that they're building something like 9,500 new units over the next couple of years. And you have buildings in the neighborhood that I think you're pretty familiar with, that I used to live in, Lincoln Square, where you know, they had three flats that are being merged into single family homes. So all these dynamics are happening at the same time: new build speculative apartments, ADUs in alleys, and, you know, de-densifying neighborhoods that traditionally were comprised of multifamily units. So I'd be curious to see where you guys sit in all that.
Yeah. So first on the blog, that was something that Emily, who you mentioned before, started essentially. So I was doing some of the writing initially when we didn't have many projects to do when we were starting the office. So I like to write and wanted to do it. So we thought it was important to start a blog, not only to show our work, but also to let people understand what architects do. I'm continually, I wouldn't even say amazed is the right word, but I guess it just all makes sense that the general public just doesn't know what we do. You know, I don't think my parents know what I do exactly. And I tell them all the time about our work. So I don't, when you're not in it and when you have, you know, a mostly suburban sort of living arrangement, I don't think you come into contact enough with architecture with the capital A to understand it, what it is that we do. So that was a reason to have why I wanted to start the blog in the first place. And Emily was actually, so our first hire was not another architect, but was Emily. She found us and was interested in what we were working on and wanted to write. So great, let's do it. So she, I would credit her with most of the good stuff that's on the blog. And I wanted to write. I always dream of maybe starting some magazine someday. That is all my interests all in one place. So I thought the blog was a good place to do that. So that's where that started. And one of the articles that you probably saw in there was about ADUs. And what you said is entirely accurate. It, all the lower density, but highly important 2, 3, 4 unit buildings that are dispersed in the inner blocks around Chicago are being deconverted to single family. So we're losing units there. And then all of those are being displaced by the huge number of units that are being built in the West Loop, which I'm never going to be against density. I think that's a good thing. But it needs to be spread out. And you know, I think the comfortable densities of Europe, like Paris, is beautiful because it just is, but also because there's just a consistent 5 or 6 story kind of medium density over across the entire city. And that allows for all the things that we all as city dwellers say we like restaurants and shops and all those sorts of things, which have maybe been upended in the past couple of years. But we say we like all those things, but we don't want the density that it takes to support them. And when we lose the mid-block 2 and 3 flats, I think it does a disservice when they're not displaced close by. But being sent all to the West Loop. So I don't know if that is where the idea to resurrect ADUs and granny flats and coach houses in Chicago started, but whatever it is, I'm glad that they're there. But what we're seeing, and we have a couple of these projects right now, we haven't actually built one yet because the program's only been around for 9 months or a year or so, but we have a couple that are about to go in for permit and will be built. But it seems to me to be benefiting the people that are able to afford construction. I don't know that it's actually going to help regular homeowner because the upfront cost to build these is pretty high still because the garages were never set up to be habitable spaces. So you have to get utilities out there and you have to heat it and cool it and bring electricity there and bring plumbing and sewer there. And just the infrastructure alone is pretty expensive. So, I'm hoping over time enough of these get built and enough people then rent them that it does provide more density in cities. But what I fear, and a couple of our projects are doing this, is that they're really just another place for someone to have a home office or to have another family member live, which is not a bad thing either. Multi-generational housing is a positive thing. So that's not bad. But as far as it helping our housing shortage, I don't know if it's going to ultimately do that. It certainly won't hurt, but there has to be a way to build more of these. But I think all of this is just a shirking of responsibility from government in general of building affordable housing for people. And no city is doing enough of it just because the fight on their hands is so high and there's a political risk there to supporting it. And I get that, but there's really no other option. And little units here and there are not going to make up for the 30-year shortfall that we've had.
Yeah, and I mean, thinking on the infrastructure level, on the public infrastructure level as well. You know, you describe yourself as a bike warrior, and the immediate picture that came to mind for me was the Fred Armisen in the Portlandia series yelling "bike lane" at everyone, yeah, including in the grocery store. But I would like you to paint your own picture of that what that means to you and how you think that the cities, how Chicago's doing with the bike safety and bike access in general, and what you think more could be done in cities.
When that skit came out, Laura did jokingly say that's me, but I don't think it is, but that's what she said. But I think that it's, you know, I'm out there, as with all the other bikers, without any armor or protection aside from our helmet. So I consider that to be a warrior. And especially when, you know, I started doing it 20 years ago in San Diego. And not that I'm any kind of pioneer, bicycles have been around long before I ever was, but in San Diego it was a little weird to be commuting to work. And no joke, I had to go uphill both ways. That is a true story. And you know, I just found it completely refreshing and rewarding. Like, I didn't necessarily think about the environmental benefits at the time. I just thought it would be a fun thing to do to start my day and end my day. But I've done it ever since. And I think, you know, almost everyone at the office right now bikes to the office. And we bike to our job sites and to our meetings. And I just find it keeps me happier than if I was stuck in a car. And, you know, we wonder about our lack of happiness in this country, and are always shocked by how Scandinavian countries and Denmark and are always the happiest people, even though, you know, it's dark for 18 hours a day in the winter. But I think they just drive less. I mean, has anyone ever thought about that? It's just simply that, that we're not angry. I mean, you hear we hear cars honking their horn all day outside our studios. So there's a lot of anger out there. And I feel like biking just lets that melt all away. But you do have to have some fortitude out there, which is what I feel the warrior is that we have to be always aware and deliberate in our actions, because we are vulnerable being amongst those 2-ton metal
death machines. You bubbles. Can say it.
Yes. Yeah. we have a car too. I'm not, you know, I'm not averse to driving when it's necessary, but I feel like most trips can be done on a bicycle, and I just feel more rewarding to do that. And lucky for all of us, there is a sustainability benefit to it all.
Indeed. And I mean, I think that, you know, I know some cities like New York and London have implemented what they call like Project Zero, which is basically trying to make sure that there are zero cyclist deaths per year. And I know that not everyone's been successful with that, obviously, unfortunately. Do you think that it comes down to dedicating bike lanes and painting them green or some bright color, or putting them on the, you know, interstitial space between the parking lane and the traffic lane? Or is it more a question of education or just ubiquity of bikes themselves? Or maybe it's a combination of all three.
Yeah, certainly all three things. But I think that we've designed our transportation systems for the past 70 years to, in order to move vehicles as quickly through everywhere as possible. And that's what happens when engineers design places and architects don't, is that you get that sort of model. And turns out it doesn't really work very well. Freeways are jammed, people are unhappy, it takes forever to get everywhere. So I think we've realized now that is not the right thing to do, because you'll just never be able to build as many lanes as you need. So we need to build the public space, the right of way, the space in between our buildings, so that we are encouraging the forms of transportation that we want. And I think that happens to be bikes and feet and not cars, because I think it would have many benefits through all sectors of life. But until we re-examine how that right of way is designed, I don't know that it will ever be safe, and we'll never get to zero deaths of pedestrians and cyclists, because just what the space wasn't built for us. It was built for cars moving fast. So that's what we need to re-examine first before we worry about painting and zero deaths.
Right. Yeah. It's the whole fact that everything's engineered for cars. Indeed. If the accessory dwelling units continue to be built above garages for cars, it's not like we're removing that use from that piece of property. We're just adding density to it. And I can already foresee the neighborhood meetings where people are saying, but the traffic, if you add another granny flat to this, let alone 9,500 apartments in the West Loop where people are yelling, but the traffic. It always strikes me how unimaginative people are in those arguments. Like, they can never imagine a future where we're not all driving our own cars. And, I don't know what we can do to convince them that that is coming, not only with autonomous vehicles and perhaps less commuting, but also, people becoming more environmentally responsible and interested in maybe a less stress-free, stressful way to get around. But I guess as a practitioner of an architecture firm that, as opposed to a public policymaker, what do you think you can do, besides go on widely listen to podcasts like this and speak the gospel?
Well, aside from actually doing it, and biking to sites, and it's funny, whenever we show up at a job site on our bikes and the contractors are there, they all showed up in their F-150s. Right. But they're never, it's never, they're always like just pleasantly surprised. It's more like, I wish I could do that. Or only if this was different and this was different, I'd be able to do it. So I think people want to. It's just, it takes some effort to get there. Aside from setting the example ourselves, that's what we try and do. But from an advocacy perspective, I think all of our work that isn't necessarily paid is about making the right of way a better space for all of us. And that started many years ago with what's called Parking Day. And that's a one-day takeover. It started in San Francisco. One-day takeover of a parking space where you pay the meter for the day, and instead of parking a car there, you turn it into a park for the day. Because really, I'm just leasing space. So what I decide to do with it is up to me, because I've paid for this space, so I can put whatever I want there. So you pay the parking meter for the entire day, you turn it into a park. And that was a one-day thing. And then parklets started as a result of that, which are more seasonal, at least here in Chicago. And they're semi-permanent takeovers of parallel parking spaces. And a lot of them were used by restaurants to set up tables and chairs out there, or just general hangout, relax areas. We've built a couple of them that are still around the city. And then permanent takeovers of those spaces. You see dedicated bike lanes now, like on Milwaukee Avenue here in Chicago. But we set an example right here in front of the building that we developed that was 12 diagonal asphalt parking spaces that would regularly be littered with Popeye's garbage and floodwater. And thought, well, there's got to be a better use for that space. We don't need those parking spaces there. We don't have a parkway. It's not benefiting anyone. There was a hit and run at our intersection, mainly because I think it was such a car oriented and asphalt expanse that, of course, that something like that's going to happen. So we lobbied with the alderman and with our community group here to turn those parking spaces into an actual permanent parkway, which is now here right now. So what was those ugly parking spaces are now 4 red oak trees and a native landscape that I'm happy to report had some butterflies and hummingbirds last year. And something that I think was just the culmination of that first parking day is that, we have this right of way. It belongs to all of us taxpayers in the city. Is there a better way to use this than just jamming cars as fast as possible or depositing them for a few hours? Can we think about any other way where not only does it look nicer, it's more aesthetically pleasing, but how can it divert stormwater? How can it help prevent urban heat island effect? Thinking about all these other benefits on top of each other that are certainly better than storing cars for a short period of time. So that's how we think about improving just the public realm. And I think all of those things that we do inherently improves the bike landscape in Chicago.
Yeah, I mean, and just being able to think of land as being usable for more than one thing is really the first cognitive step that needs to be undertaken. And you know, we used to think of things that way, but then, you know, I think the Industrial Revolution encouraged separation of uses, and that gave us zoning and suburban type development, and you know, that gets us to where we are today. But I do think that the, you know, the pandemic was interesting in that it got people back into their immediate neighborhoods by necessity, and interested in the street, because there was nowhere else to go really. Most indoor businesses were closed. Definitely the resurgence of the, you know, you saw the outdoor dining with the restaurants, some more successful than others. But the, you know, the obverse of that, of course, was also people were driving more because they didn't want to take public transportation. So, I mean, I don't know what the next vibe shift, if you will, that's going to happen. You know, but what needs to happen is for those instincts, you know, to come together in a way that allows us to have a more, you know, equitable urban environment. And I think I'm very much in admiration of the work that you guys are doing, especially, you know, you're thinking, you're broadcasting big ideas by doing small incremental changes and then broadcasting those changes, which is really all you can do, really. I mean, I think, you know, most people just kind of figure, well, there's nothing I can do about these intractable situations because they're public policy failures, they're huge scale. But, you know, living by doing or learning by doing is so key.
For sure. And it's all things that we enjoy doing just as part of our lives. And why, you know, I mentioned this earlier, but I like things outside of architecture and I have other interests. And I've always wanted to merge those into our practice somehow. And luckily they're centered around these kind of things. But you know, I want to make space in my life for those. So I think that's why we practice the way we do and have time to make these incursions into public space and not wait around for someone to make the policy for us. Because until someone sees it, it's going to be hard to convince anyone. And I feel the same way about our development work. And you know, until developers who are designing on spreadsheets maybe see that there's another way, another successful way to do it, then they're not going to be interested. So let's set the example. And hopefully the people that are interested in it find us. And the ones that don't or don't want to, then they can continue doing it however they want to do it. But I think there's a better way out there, and we want to try and find it.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for spending the time with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.